This is John Williams. Rokan and Anna DeVlantis are in these studios in about 25 minutes. Let's take some time to visit with Jeremy McCarter. He's got a book out. You know, we've been featuring a lot of the authors that are going to be appearing at LitFest or are. I mean, everything from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to maybe names in literature you more know, although this isn't Jabbar's first book either. But now, Young Radicals in the War for American Ideals is a book written by the, it says here on the cover, number one New York Times bestselling co-author of Hamilton the Revolution, Jeremy McCarter is here. He's a Chicagoan, and he's in our studio. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Boy, you got to love that as sort of a tagline, don't you? That'll get you into a lot of places.
Well, I guess we'll find out. You know, the book comes out in a few days in a world not at all like the one I expected it would arrive into. But it's getting close now.
Your book, Young Radicals, this is not a book about today. It's a book about 100 years ago.
Right. It's becoming more of a book about today than I anticipated that it would be. But my original impulse was to tell a story about this fascinating moment of our national story that happened almost exactly 100 years ago.
1913, 1912, 1911, around there.
Yeah, this moment of unbelievable promise when the country was leaping ahead. I got excited about this when I was in college. It felt like our ambitions and our dreams were getting a little small, and we were arguing around the margins about the things that we needed to fix. And I looked at this era when socialism and progressivism and the suffrage movement and modernism were all hitting at the same time, and people just had these vast hopes for what America could become.
What happened to those hopes?
They all got the legs kicked out from under them when the United States went into World War One in 1917. And so what drew me to it, dramas change, right? And so there's this immense change in 1917 when we go from this moment of great hope and anticipation to repression and cynicism. And the people who had been so hopeful 10 years earlier are now coming out the other side as the lost generation.
Well, that's interesting. So how were those hopefuls regarded then as we went into World War One?
They were rabble rousers. They were troublemakers. This was a generation. So I picked these five figures that I thought were particularly fascinating, and I liked the way that they held together. I thought they could sustain a single story. It's nonfiction, but I still wanted it to be a story. And they had grown up knowing only peace and relative prosperity, and so they were willing to take big chances. You know, when they got to the plate, they took big swings.
Give me an example.
So you have somebody like John Reed, who was a Harvard graduate who was not particularly distinguished when he was there. He went abroad and had a bunch of ugly American adventures. But when he came back, he started getting radicalized. He started identifying more with workers and the way that the economic system of this country was not letting them have the chance to thrive. And so he decides that the way to help people understand what's going on in Paterson, New Jersey, where there's an enormous silk strike, is to stage a pageant where the strikers will come to Madison Square Garden in New York, and 1,000 of them will recreate what they have been doing across the river in Paterson that the press won't cover. And it's this enormous creative breakthrough for the way people can tell their own stories. And it was something that, you know, no one thought was going to work.
What did they demonstrate? What did they do?
They recreated the scenes from the strike. So why they walked out when they wanted an 8-hour day and better conditions. There were the labor leaders' speeches that they had given to rally the workers in Paterson, the same leaders reproduced on stage for the enormous audience in Madison Square Garden.
You know, an ism that I have trouble with these days is nationalism.
Right.
You know, we're Americans. I believe that Americans wear the white hat in the world. I still do. I always will. And I think it's been true in my life and in our history.
Yeah.
That's nationalism. What do we do with that? And is that changing how we regard that?
I think it is. Nationalism is something that we tend to think of as being a relic of the past. But I think what we're seeing these days is that nationalism is something that's programmed deep into us as human beings. We want to feel that we belong to a group and that that group has some dignity. And I think a lot of people have been feeling completely left out from the progress of American society, and they're retaliating. One of the interesting moments of this story I try to tell, there was a social critic named Randolph Bourne. He was an incredible, young, brilliant writer. He was a hunchback. He had a kind of deformed face. He was always an outsider, even among his friends. And what he saw when he looked around in 1916, with World War I raging, is that the Germans and the French and the Americans and the Russians weren't fighting each other in America. They were getting along. And what it made him realize is that there is something special about this country. American exceptionalism means, for the first time, as he puts it, we have realized the hope of the nations, which is that all of these different kinds of people can find a way to live side by side. And what he wanted to do was articulate a way to get that nationalistic feeling, but attach it to something that would include everybody.
How are we doing on that today?
Not great. You know, he articulated this vision of transnational America in 1916. Once the war started in 1917, he never mentioned it again, because it's absurd to talk about being a home to all the nations when you're fighting Germany. But, you know, in the last couple of months, when you listen to what people have been saying, listen to the defenses of the travel ban, listen to the arguments that are supposed to back up Make America Great Again, they're all talking about a specific idea of what America is supposed to be. And it was something that used to exist. We're reaching backwards to reclaim some America that we've lost. Bourne's paradox was to say, actually, America's cultural identity is something that we all have to create together. Everybody. You can't reach back. We weren't all here 50 years ago. We're here now. We have to figure this out.
So when you were writing the book, I mean, and then you've been working on this book for six, 7 years, right?
6 years, yeah.
Okay. So Donald Trump wasn't a candidate 6 years ago. So you were writing this historical piece. And what was your objective? To sort of say, these are people who are hopeful. And it did not work out. They don't win in their lifetimes. World War I happens. The attitude changes. Looking back, were they winners? Did they have a positive influence on this country?
Yeah, I think for sure that they did. I mean, it's an interesting question. I wrestled with it a lot at the end, particularly with everything that was happening in January, which is when I had to let the thing finally go to press. You can't ever really say the last word when someone's fighting for an ideal, the way these five were, because it's a relay race. And it started before any of us got here, and it's going to continue after we're gone.
So, and you're talking about social reform, things like minimum wage, stuff like that. Well, a lot of those things are a lot better now than they were then, right?
Absolutely.
Progress has been made, maybe on their shoulders. But then you're writing this, and then you see the Trump campaign come along, and you got very discouraged, didn't you?
Right. I had my introduction all teed up and ready to go on November 7th, 2016. And then the next night I realized, well, I guess I'm going to have to reframe my book now, because I thought I was telling the story about this chapter in America's progress towards the realization of its ideals and what an immense next step forward that was going to be to elect a woman president finally. And then it turns out I'm telling a different kind of story, which is the exact phenomenon that I had just spent 6 years writing about. I can't tell you how insane it was to feel like I have just been writing about this feeling and now I am feeling it myself, which is, I have had it all wrong. I thought I understood this country and the direction in which it was moving. The optimism that I was writing about, I felt in the Obama years. And now suddenly, did I have this completely backwards? And that's what we're all grappling with now.
Is the mistake we make vilifying the people who voted for Trump then? I mean, because really, they don't know you. They're not mad at you. Right. They're simply saying, it wasn't all so rosy. It was so screwed up for us, or we are so disenchanted with this America that we're going to vote for Donald Trump.
Right.
I think, you know, we need to heed that message.
Right. I think it's a terrible mistake to demonize the people who voted for Donald Trump. I think people cast their votes for lots of different reasons, and that part of the problem that got us into this is trying to paint everybody with the same brush. I mean, even look, in my era, it's not like suddenly a bad guy came along and then everything falls apart. Woodrow Wilson was the president that decided to fight Germany in 1917. This wasn't some sort of reactionary warmonger. I mean, he did it for idealistic reasons, which is one of the reasons why then at the end, everyone is so disillusioned. And, you know, for now, you know, the Trump era, whatever the set of reasons that led people to vote for him, I still think now it's the old challenge. It's, can we come together and find a way to defend the same things that the Young Radicals were trying to defend?
And the Young Radicals is the title of your book, and the War for American Ideals, set not in 2017 or 2016, but set almost exactly 100 years ago. I don't know if history repeats itself as a good thing or a bad thing here, but I'm still optimistic. I mean, if we are, like I had this conversation with my sons the other night, and they didn't give me a pass on it, but I said none of us knew how bad it would be. So if I didn't vote for Donald Trump, I was guessing that a Trump presidency would be a bad thing. It's worse than I imagined. The people who did vote for Donald Trump, it's worse than they imagined it was going to be. They thought he might be a good president, or maybe he'll be a marginal president, but he won't be wackadoodle. Turns out he's wackadoodle. They could not have known how bad it would be. My kids didn't give me that. But that's where I am on this one. Right. And I'm still optimistic that we're going to figure this out and we will still be the country of promise that we've always been.
Right.
Do you share that?
I do. I mean, I think about hope a lot. And I can't remember now where I encountered this in the research. I wish I could. I got to look this up. But someone said that hope isn't optimism. It's not thinking that things are going to turn out for the best. Hope only has meaning if it's your impulse to work to make it better. That's the difference. It's hope expresses itself in action to try to bring about the thing that you want to see. And so I'm a hopeful person. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, except having just written about this immense like rise and fall of American prospects. I am concerned about the way the arrows are pointing, but I also know that if we got through 1919 and the race riots and the Red Scare and the arrival of J. Edgar Hoover in an unsuspecting world, we'll get through what's coming.
Every now and then I think about that. Like, think about the 1960s when we were assassinating, you know, attorneys general, presidents, and civil rights leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't know how we would handle that today. We've been through some crazy times before. Before I let you go, have you seen the Chicago cast of Hamilton?
I have seen the Chicago cast. They're
how many
incredible.
Times?
Three,
yeah.
I think.
And still loving it?
Still loving it. I was very blessed to get to spend the same 6 years I worked on Young Radicals around Hamilton. And the most exciting thing about it is that it's alive. The show is alive. So they've replaced all of the people. It's none of the original actors in Chicago. And it's the same but different. It's like a living thing is alive. And it changes night to night, and it's beautiful.
Hmm. Jeremy, thanks for coming into our studio. You live in Chicago, right?
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Come to our studio more often. Visit with us again.
I'd love to.
It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
By the way, you're appearing at LitFest, right?
That's right.
Do you know offhand when and where you're going to be?
I do. I will be talking about Young Radicals with the great Alexander Heyman on Sunday morning, the 11th at 11 a.m.
Okay. The book is titled Young Radicals, Jeremy McCarter. It's 2:50. This is WGN. So we were just talking about the difference between what happened and when you wrote your book about these young radicals, idealistic people living in a time of prosperity, and then all of a sudden everything goes to the pooper because World War I is looming, and that idealism and hope at least dies for a while. And you liken that in your book to what's happening now, even though when you were writing the book, you did not know how that was going to end.
Right.
I said to you off the air on your way out the door, Jeremy, I said, don't you think maybe social media will save us from some of our worst impulses? I know the president can use it and the government can spy on us with social media tools, but I don't know. It seems to me to be a very democratic, small d, tool that the people have now that they didn't have when you were writing. And then you started to say what?
Well, that social media is a way of riling people up. And the American people got really, really riled up in 1917. The United States went into war on a scale it had never experienced before. The Committee on Public Information, which was the propaganda arm of the federal government, riled people up even more. And then you start seeing really atrocious things start to happen. There are these vigilante groups that are semi-sanctioned by the Department of Justice. They're going out and doing terrible things to their citizens.
Americans spying on Americans.
Yes, so many, in fact, that the Bureau of Investigation at the Justice Department couldn't process the tips they were getting fast enough because there were thousands of them coming in every day. You have German shopkeepers getting tarred and feathered. There are race riots. There's the Red Scare, which is a very industrious J. Edgar Hoover relying on this network he has built of people informing on their neighbors. It's not to say that any of this is going to happen again, but what it is to say is I am watching very carefully not the specific actors doing specific things, but the climate in which they're doing it.
I sense more pushback, though. I don't see the momentum going in the direction you're describing. I see people becoming aware of whatever the latest version of that is and pushing back.
Right. Well, John, that's it. It's peacetime. I mean, if there's an attack, if the thing that happened in London over the weekend were to happen in Times Square or right here, we're looking out on Michigan Avenue, then how far can you push people to start informing on their neighbors? And I want to think that, as you said, I mean, with, this is really a test of having spent these years around Hamilton. Like, this is a test of the system that those guys created in the 18th century. They built in all these safeguards. They tried to defend the country against a tyrant taking over, against people who are going to tear the system apart from within. I think the system's going to hold. I think that we're not going to go back to the repression of 1919. I also think that this is the best it's going to be because we haven't been attacked. It's not wartime. There isn't any sort of rallying to the flag about Americans dying that way. And if that holds, I'm confident.
It's a hell of a test, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the worst we've faced since the Civil War.
Hmm. Well, on that happy note, why don't you leave?
Yeah.
I'm so glad I invited you back. Seriously, the book is called Young Radicals, and it's great history. It's also, as you can tell, really relevant these days, from Jeremy McCarter. He is the co-author of Hamilton, The Revolution. He wrote that with Lin-Manuel Miranda. That was on the New York Times bestseller list. How long before this one gets there, too? He's speaking on Sunday, right?
Sunday.
At
11 a.m., Printers Row, Alexander Heyman.
Thanks for coming into the studio.
It's
2:57, Row and Anna will, too. That's next.